This podcast is from the IDPF Digital Book 2012 Conference at Book Expo America.
Good morning, everyone. Just a little bit more about me. I run a company called Giant Steps Media Technology Strategies, which is a consultancy which has been in business for, it'll be 12 years next week. Located just up in the Columbus Circle area, just a little bit too far to walk, as is everything else in Manhattan, too far to walk to the Javits Center. I spend about half my time doing strategy work, digital strategy work for publishers, particularly on the content management workflow, digital distribution side. And the other half I spend on this area of content protection. I did write a book about DRM for Wiley back in 2001 in ancient times. I get thought of as the DRM guy, for better or for worse. And my attitude about DRM is I'm in favor of anything that gets content creators paid, whatever that may be. So what I want to do today is to talk to you about sort of where the landscape is in the book publishing world, since we're at a book publishing conference, on content protection, various ways of doing that technically, and then talk about what I'm doing with IDPF and kind of where it fits in. So publishers are looking to fight copyright infringement in various ways, publishers, movie studios, record labels, et cetera. And there is no magic bullet. Everyone acknowledges it's a big problem. Publishers who look at this from a broad brush, the legal department or whatever, will look at a number of different angles. And these are the four basic buckets. And this characterization of buckets comes from the book Code and Other Laws of Cyberspace, which was the first book by Lawrence Lessig, professor at Harvard Law School. A fantastic book, regardless of whether you agree or disagree with some of his ideas. And what he said basically is you can think of any society or any environment, including cyberspace, as consisting of legal, economic, behavioral, and technical aspects. And so copyright infringement or copyright can be dealt with in each of those ways. Today, we are talking about the technical aspect of it. There are legal aspects such as strengthening copyright law, economic aspects such as making it easier and or cheaper to get content legitimately, behavioral aspects such as education. We're going to talk today about the technical aspects. And the idea is really just to say technical is just one piece of a much larger puzzle. So what are the technical methods for protecting copyright? Well, they fall into two broad categories, which generically speaking I call proactive and reactive. So the proactive type of protection is to limit what readers can do with the content by encrypting it, by requiring special hardware or software to decrypt it and then read it, print it, or whatever you're going to do with it. Typically, this involves tying access to the content to a particular device, such as an e-reader or a PC or whatever, or to a user identity of some sort. It may involve putting an expiration date and time, such as in a library lending scenario, and it may involve putting limitations on things like printing, copying to clipboard, and so on. For example, Kindle doesn't allow copying to clipboard. Then we have the reactive side, where you don't limit what the consumer can do, but instead you use certain techniques to search for infringing copies and identify where they came from, essentially, what they are and where do they come from. And you can do this either by looking at the content for certain clues in the content itself or you can look at it by looking at the content itself, trying to figure out what it is, or you can look at the content within the content for certain clues hidden in the content. And I'm being very loose with my terminology because I'm about to introduce terminology. And the idea here in terms of infringement is really if you're going to go after infringers, you're doing this to create evidence to go after somebody legally. So we have names for these two types of techniques. On the left, the proactive techniques, we call them DRM. DRM has meant many different things to many different people. Back when the field started, it meant a much wider range of things than what we typically associate with the term today. It meant any sort of technology that helps rights holders manage their rights, whether it involves encryption or just a database of who owns what or whatever it is. Now it seems to pertain particularly to this proactive method of copyright control, and other certain writers also use the term to apply to things like the screws that Apple uses on their devices, or the glue used to close devices. That's hardware DRM. And content identification is a term that's used to describe the reactive terms, and that in turn breaks down into two specific types of techniques, one of which is called watermarking, the other one of which is called fingerprinting, and I'll explain what those are shortly. So we're going to talk mainly about DRM today because that's what Bill McCoy is working with me on, and that's kind of the hot topic. Let's just look at some pros and cons. Does it prevent piracy? The answer is we don't know. And in fact, there was a General Accounting Office study 2 years ago that basically said we may never know. So it's sort of maybe it'll do something. We just don't know. There are studies. I've read them all. They all have problems. They are all either methodologically flawed, or they were commissioned by some organization that had a certain outcome in mind and, you know, that wanted to put something out there. For retailers, what does DRM do? It enables lock-in to your retailing platform, such as Amazon or Barnes & Noble, or in music, it used to be iTunes. For libraries, it enables e-lending. That's been a wonderful thing for libraries, to be able to lend e-books in a way that satisfies libraries' needs to make books available on a reasonable basis to people who may not be able to physically go to the library. That's a great thing. Distributors and e-reader vendors, hardware software vendors, it costs them something to implement. And one of the big problems with this technology is that those who want it do not pay for it. That's a problem. For users, it restricts portability, and it restricts the sharing of ebooks. There are certain technologies that allow sharing under certain conditions, but in general they are restricted. Same with borrowing. You have a lending feature in the Amazon and Nook technologies, but again, it's limited. It has to be approved by publishers, which is a whole nother discussion. Now, the main thing to consider is the effect of DRM on the overall e-reading market. The mission of the IDPF, as I understand it, and Bill can correct me if I'm wrong, is to increase the overall e-reading market, increase opportunities for everyone, and increase the overall market. Certainly that is what publishers want. That is what everybody, authors want. And the current status is that fragmentation of DRMs has led to We argue, or I argue at least, hampered growth in the overall e-reading market. So here's what we mean by fragmentation. Right now, in production, there are at least these seven DRMs for different e-reading platforms, including Amazon, the Adobe technology that's used by various vendors, Apple's technology for the iPad and iPhone, screen image, or what I call screenshot DRM, which is what Google uses, and various others. And this isn't even counting the at least three other vendors I know, and I'm sure there are more than that, who are trying to sell new technologies for protecting content into the market, one of which I learned about yesterday. So let's compare this with what's going on in other media market segments. So right now in ebooks, we've got this fragmented market, and I'll discuss shortly, you know, why that's bad or what the alternatives are. In music, paid downloads over the internet have been generally DRM-free for the past 3 years or so. And What Apple has done is they've substituted other little tricks to put boundaries around their ecosystem. They don't use encryption on their files, but instead they've taken away functions from iTunes such as codec and format conversion, and they've introduced other little speed bumps into their ecosystem, thus proving that you don't need DRM to lock people in. It helps maybe, but that's not the only thing that locks people in. How many people use a streaming subscription service like Spotify or Rhapsody or Moog or a good number of your Pandora, which is the radio type service? They encrypt their streams, and yes, you can capture the audio. You know, if you want, you can put a mic in front of the loudspeaker, but it's generally considered to be too much of a pain to bother with. The mobile subscription services such as Spotify and Rhapsody do use DRM for what they call offline listening mode. You can download tracks to your device so that you can, listen to them when you're not connected to the network. And they're there on your device as opposed to being streamed to your device, and they are, in fact, encrypted. It's just that nobody likes to call that DRM. In video, this is where content protection technologies are strongest and getting stronger, not looser or weaker. There are a lot of advanced techniques being used to protect content more tightly. And the reason for this is economic. It's very simple. Pay TV providers, cable networks, satellite networks, folks like that, they don't want their signals stolen. So they have a service that they want to protect, as opposed to Amazon, which is a service which happens to, among many other things, sell ebooks. They also sell, groceries and certainly hard copy books and a whole bunch of other things. So Amazon protects its service in various ways. Cable TV's service is pretty much the same as the content, give or take. So there's an economic alignment. The pay TV guys don't mind paying for protection because it protects their service. So there's an alignment of interest which causes the amount of complexity and expense in these operator scenarios to be much, much higher than it is in publishing or music. So you've got these more and more sophisticated techniques. In fact, I'd argue the only meaningful R&D done in this field is in the video area. You've got hacks, certainly, but you've got a lot of things that they do to blunt the impact of hacks, to make them difficult and so forth. And then there's something called ultraviolet going on in the movie space. How many people have heard of ultraviolet? Okay, so not very many of you. Ultraviolet is five of the six Hollywood studios banding together with a bunch of vendors such as Microsoft, that's the biggest one, a bunch of other ones, to create a standard where you get an account. It can be a family account. You can have up to X number of people on the account, X number of devices. I think it's 6 and 12 respectively. You download a piece of or you obtain a piece of content. It could be a Blu-ray disc or it could be a download. And then you have the right to obtain it in whatever other compliant format you want. So, for example, the most typical arrangement now is you go to Walmart, you buy a Blu-ray or a DVD in some cases, and then you get a token, which is essentially a number you type in, and it allows you to get a Microsoft DRM'd download of the same movie so you can play it on your PC or whatever other device does that for you. And then if you have it, it also gives you the right to stream the movie from any web browser. And this is the ultraviolet standard, and I notice I said five out of the six studios are participating, and Microsoft is the biggest technology vendor. Who can make a guess? If you already know, don't say, but if who can make a guess which studio is not participating? Just shout it out.
Disney.
Bingo! And it's really, the key takeaway about ultraviolet is that it's everybody banding together to compete with Apple. Hold that thought. Corporate documents is another interesting area, using this type of technology to protect confidential information. This is becoming an increasingly popular technology, particularly as an adjunct to corporate digital asset management or content management systems, such as Oracle and EMC Documentum and so forth. And it's meant to be complementary to other security technologies such as firewalls, what's called data loss prevention, single sign-on, multi-factor authentication, stuff like that. It's very strong protection. And the way it works is you author some document in Microsoft Office or Acrobat or whatever, and then you apply the protection so that only certain people within the company can read them or can change them depending on what you want to do. And the company's identity management infrastructure, which is, for those of you who are techies, something like an LDAP server or an Active Directory server, manages all the identities. So if you've got a corporate email address, you've got a corporate area on your file server, that same identity will be used in the what's called IRM, Information Rights Management. So let's talk briefly about content identification. There are two main techniques, watermarking and fingerprinting. Watermarking has gotten some notoriety lately because it's being used for EPUB ebooks from Pottermore, the Harry Potter online bookstore. And even though they're not allowed to talk about it publicly, it's sort of a badly kept secret that a Dutch company called Bookstream is doing it. And the way that works, so I'll talk about the way it works shortly. O'Reilly and Pearson's Safari Books Online for IT professionals also uses watermarking for their downloaded PDFs. Fingerprinting, so watermarking is really adding data into the file in a way that makes it difficult to remove. And this is easier in PDFs because PDFs are essentially page image formats. EPUB is really a reflowable markup language, and so it's harder to embed data that you can't easily remove. But certainly it works. It's worked well for many years for PDF. Fingerprinting is, think of taking somebody's fingerprint. That's what that means. Like if you're accused of a crime, the police will take your fingerprints and look them up in a database and see if you're in there their naughty list. Well, fingerprinting is essentially looking at content to try to see if there is a match in a database of known copyrighted materials. And a fingerprint is really a bunch of numbers that you extract from the content using an algorithm, which is, for those of you who know some math, it's a variation on what's called a hash algorithm. And it's really, for those of you who don't know math, it's really a fancy form of pattern matching. And for text, you can make it's very accurate for text. It's also used for things like video and music with a little bit less accuracy. Now, you can identify what the content is. What you can't identify is things like who downloaded it or what device downloaded it. Hacks are possible in watermarking. Watermarking is pretty easy to hack. Fingerprinting, it's irrelevant. There is no such thing as hacking a fingerprint. You're just examining bits. So a couple examples. Safari Books Online puts the user's name, my name would be Bill Rosenblatt, on every page of the document at the bottom. What Harry Potter does is it takes your user ID on Pottermore, turns it into a string of gobbledygook, and puts it onto the copyright page along with the copyright notice that nobody ever reads. My view, they did a lousy job of implementing this technology. The Bookstream technology has a lot of flexibility. They chickened out, and they did it in a very, what's the opposite of bold? Timid way. Fingerprinting is used very heavily in trade, educational, STM, and academic publishing. There are services that will crawl the web to find your content, and if it's not where it's supposed to, if it's in a place where it shouldn't be, then they'll give you information. You can decide what you want to do, if you want to try to strike a licensing deal, it depends on what it is, or how much they took of it. Did they attribute it properly? Did they provide a link back to your site, and so forth? And some of the vendors that provide this solution are Attributor, Mark Monitor is another one, Eardetto is another one. They acquired this company called BayTSP, that, for example, Cengage is one of their customers. So there's a handful of companies that do this. So then the question has come up, what about going DRM-free? There are certain publishers that have done it, mainly in the science fiction, fantasy, and IT areas. with a young and techie type. If you want the slides, I'll send them to you. Just give me your business card. Don't bother with your cameras. Okay, even better. Yeah, even better. So the fact is that most publishers besides these genres do use DRM. And certainly it's being used in library scenarios by publishers who allow lending because it's a opt-in license kind of scenario. And some publishers will, like Simon & Schuster, for example, will not do lending at all. And so it's irrelevant what they do. The higher ed guys, where the customer, the paying customer is not exactly a willing paying customer, they're committed to strong content protection and also in some professional fields. That's where we are now. So now what? The question is now what do we do? Here are four choices that are not very optimal. Status quo, everyone drop DRM right now. Standardize on a strong DRM or standardize on something like watermarking. So, you know, my opinion is the IDPF should have done this back in 2007, but they didn't. So here we are. What do we do now? Oops, we hit the microphone. Status quo, market fragmentation and slower e-readership growth, or a certain company attains a monopoly. Right now, Amazon is at about 60% market share-ish, and it could go either way. We don't know. We'll see what happens. But neither of those two outcomes are very desirable for publishers. If you go DRM-free, one thing that is for sure is that you can't go back. So once you get rid of it, there's no going back, and that, if nothing else, is holding some publishers back from taking that step. Standardizing on, and then there may be some effect on piracy, we just don't know. Standardizing on strong DRM has been proven to be overly expensive and complex. One reason why the IDPF didn't go this way, again, my opinion, 5 years ago, is because it would have been too disruptive to the current technologies that were out there. It would have caused them to have to rip out a lot of stuff and build expensive functionality. And again, the publishers are the ones who ultimately want this. And there are privacy issues with strong DRM. And the final suboptimal outcome is watermarking. And the big problem with watermarking, it might work. It's too early to tell. We'll see. There's a lot of experimentation that has to happen. The big issue with watermarking is that watermarking hacks, unlike DRM hacks, are legal. And I'll explain what that means in a minute. So what we're doing is we're exploring a new possibility. And as Bill McCoy said, this is just something we're thinking about at this point. This is not a standard. It's not anything that's being imposed on anyone. It's not even anything that's been completely designed. Something we're calling EPUB LCP, Lightweight Content Protection for EPUB 3. Obviously, it's an open, if it gets this far, it will be an open pro-competitive standard. And the basic idea is to take some personal information, it could be personal information, it's up to the retailer to decide, such as an email address or your name or even a credit card number, and to store that in an obfuscated form in the encrypted file, which means that even if you recover the key, which is the password or passphrase, you're not getting somebody's email address. You're getting something that the distributor can look up and see what the email or address or whatever it is, but it's not. It'll be obfuscated. Again, for people who know math, this is like, think of it like a hash function. You can put it something in, but you can't get it back. It's irrecoverable. This is something that's complementary to watermarking. You can take the same piece of personal information and watermark it in the file and use it to encrypt it so that even if you decrypt it, the watermark is still in there and you have some extra binding of the personal information to the file. And we would certainly want to include expiry period or expiration period support for the library application. So here, you know, we say lightweight. Well, what does that mean? Well, specific to EPUB LCP, what it means is the basic idea is If you want to share this with someone, you send them a copy of the file, you give them your password, they can read it. That's it. So if it is your personal information, it becomes a question of how comfortable are you sharing that personal information? Another aspect is this will not phone home. This will not contact a server, which means, for example, you can use the content offline without a network connection if you're on an airplane or whatever, or in the subway here in New York. And even if the company goes out of business, you can still use it. That's been a problem with other DRMs. In fact, something that the Federal Trade Commission is looking into. And we're thinking about it in a way that it can be extended to other markets that need other functionality, such as the kind of family accounts that ultraviolet type scheme might support, or more heavier security, such as, for example, the higher ed market might want. Here's some more information on what we mean by heavy versus light. And I've been looking at these technologies for 15 years or whatever it is and have seen them evolve. File sharing is restricted under a heavyweight technology. And when I say heavyweight, what I have in mind is something like what they use on pay TV. What I do not have in mind is something like what Amazon uses for ebooks right now, which is kind of midweight. Net connections are required for heavyweight DRM. They're not required for lightweight. What I call a one-click hack is something that once you, the average non-technical user, get the hack, you can use it without any technical knowledge. It will just work on all your files. It will work forever. And it won't apply to just some files. It applies to any files you want. So an example of that is the hack that's available for DVD encryption, which, because it's a very weak scheme, it took this Norwegian kid a few weeks to figure out that there's one set of encryption keys that applies to every DVD on Earth. And so the hack became made available, and it's a one-click hack. One-click hacks would be possible under a lightweight scheme. They are not possible under a heavyweight scheme where you can have a hack, but it's recoverable, it's mitigatable. Is that even a word? I'm not sure. If there's an editor out there, please tell me. But both lightweight and heavyweight hacks are against the anti-circumvention law, which we have in the U.S. and Europe and various other countries. And then, of course, there's more flexibility on business models with a heavyweight DRM where you get into something like ultraviolet versus a lightweight DRM. So I don't have that much time left, so I'm going to go quickly through some of the rest of this. This is just an idea of where we want to be on this scale of light versus heavy. On the left side, you've got a watermark, which is no DRM. On the right side, you've got a heavy DRM, such as what you find in pay television. In the middle, you've got things like Adobe Content Server and AZW for Amazon. And we're trying to be both figuratively and literally somewhat to the left of those technologies, but still within the anti-circumvention law. And there is a rich case history of litigation in the U.S., which makes it pretty clear what falls within the anti-circumvention law and what doesn't. And that's, I could spend an hour talking just about that, which I will not, but feel free to ask me later. So there are a few business models that are not by design supported by this lightweight scheme, and you can look at those. I'm not going to talk about them now. But the basic idea is we have a window of opportunity here. We see more fragmentation happening in the market. We see Amazon at a tipping point type market share. We see e-reading going outside of the U.S. and Western European markets into markets with much higher piracy rates, such as Brazil, China, Russia, etc., where there's more of a disregard for copyright, both at the population level, consumer level, and at the government level, where they have laws that are just not enforced. And then, of course, there is the transition to EPUB 3, so there's a timeliness to that. So what the IDPF has done, as Bill said, is they've engaged me to help them with this. We're at a draft requirement stage, which you can see on idpf.org. It's there. It's a sort of a bare-bones document at this point. Soliciting feedback, the deadline for which is this Friday?
Actually, anytime in June will be
high. No, it won't. this Friday. And you can either post comments there or email them to Bill at that address. So you can also look at my blog, copyrightandtechnology.com. And if you're in London week after next, I have a conference, Copyright and Technology London, June 19th in London. If you want to come see me, I'll give you a complimentary pass. So we have a few minutes for questions. If anyone would like to, please come up to the mic and make a comment or ask a question, that would be great. The mic's back there. Yeah, maybe you can tilt the mic up or something.
It doesn't work. It didn't work the last session.
They haven't fixed it?
No.
All right, you'll just have to speak louder then.
All right, so you referred to layering in your blog about lightweight content protection. And I wanted to understand which parties would do what layering.
Okay, let me give you one example. There are many different, there's a long answer to this, but let me give you just one example. One thing that I haven't talked about is something called robustness rules. So in the world of video DRMs and some music DRMs, there's something called robustness rules, which are basically part of the technology license for whatever the DRM is. For example, Microsoft PlayReady or Marlin from InterTrust or Flash Access. Adobe Access, no longer called Flash Access, from Adobe. And that means that if you're going to implement this technology on let's say here's an Android phone, I'm going to implement one of these technologies on this Android phone, and I'm the developer who's implementing this. It means that I can't just throw it on there and give hackers the opportunity to do things like find the key to the encryption stored in RAM in plain sight. I need to take certain technical measures to protect keys, to protect from reverse engineering, to protect from various types of hacks, substitution hacks, debuggers, various things like that. And so you're contractually obligated to take steps to prevent against all these different things. This has turned out to be the part of the iceberg that's below the waterline in implementing DRMs where the DRM is independent of the platform on which it runs. We envision not requiring this for EPUB LCP because it is an expensive pain in the neck. However, somebody operating in, let's say, the higher ed market could envision attaching robustness rules to a licensing agreement for this technology so that for higher ed content, it's harder to hack. That would be one example. Other examples would include support for different business models, layering different authentication techniques so that you support things like family accounts and whatnot. Thad.
The question I have, Bill, is I was in the meeting a year ago where this first came up, and you spoke very well there, and I thought you did an excellent job of positioning it, Bill, so that, you know, to say that the association has to be responsible to its members, the association's not taking a position, and that's great. So then, but what happens when you put something as emotional as DRM to your membership, then all hell breaks loose, as it did just at that meeting. Now, here we are coming a year later, and you know, we've got the best in the Bill's the best in the business, right? There's no one who knows as much about this stuff as Bill Rosenblatt, so you can just be comfortable at that level. No further endorsement required. If you can find anyone who knows more, let us know, because we've never heard of them. So Bill's got all the experience, and what's the great thing with Bill's experience is he knows the music side and he knows the video side, which everyone knows has a lot more at stake than a federal book, $299. And they've got, you know, this is Hollywood, and they've got much more ego in it and so on. So Bill knows about that stuff too, and he's followed the music stuff since day one. So I'm listening to this and thinking, I'm really glad that you're putting this forward. Why am I than they're doing today. Just be sure they've got someone in the
Well, I want to answer it as well, but you...
And then there's this whole independent scene that's growing up where none of this matters anyway.
Let me deal with the first of those. The independent scene is a whole nother set of issues, and Bill may want to add to what I say or disagree with it. Realistically, there is never one of anything in the tech market, with one exception, which is HTML. Okay, so... where's the metadata standard for publishing? I don't agree with that. I mean, that's like saying that all devices use metal. Yeah, I think XML is wonderful and it's done a lot of good, but it's not sufficient. The reason why HTML succeeded is because it was done very early and very firmly and before it was a market. Tim Berners-Lee did this before there was a commercial internet, like 3-4 years before there was a commercial internet, there was HTML, and he rode that like a stallion. If you try to impose a standard after there is an established market, you will never get to one. What you will get to is, if you're lucky, 2 or 3. And I read it. I wrote an article on paidcontent.org, which explores the and this kind of had to do with the discussion that Bill McCoy and I have been having. That basically says, you know, everyone thinks that MP3 is the universal standard for music. No, it's not. It's not. It's sort of an oasis, a mirage. That's the word. It's kind of a mirage. And I think realistically, we'll get to 2 or 3 in this market. We just want to make sure that it's the right 2 or 3. So do you want to add anything to that?
No, from an IDPF point of view, briefly, so we can have maybe 2 more questions before we have to wrap up. The only thing I want to add is, as a standards development organization, I view our job as kind of like plumbers, people who build plumbing fittings. If you need standard plumbing fittings for some reason, you come to it and it's around EPUB, it's around taking web standards and making them into portable documents that can be distributed, you come to us and say, hey, help us make some fittings. And maybe some other people really hate the kind of stuff you're going to put through your plumbing pipes and have philosophical disagreements about the kind of plumbing, but that's kind of, in a certain respect, as a standards organization, if a set of people want something, it's sort of our, we feel it is, some of us feel, it is our job to supply it. But that sounds pretty good and moral, but then you start to say, well, what if you're like building nuclear weapons, you know, or you're arms merchant? And so there is a philosophical concern here that I want to acknowledge, and it kind of makes me depressed too sometimes. So because I've been a DRM peddler, you know, and it wasn't my intention to do it again. So I want to recognize that emotional aspect and the fact that it is a tricky issue between, oh, we're just doing the plumbing and we're an arms merchant doing things that are not good. But we, as Bill started this off with, we do come from the premise of creating an open, interoperable, level playing field for content, and we do think fragmentation, you know, is by definition, it's not interoperable if it's fragmented, and we do want to help authors and publishers make money. We think that's actually good for readers too, because if they're not making money, they're not going to write and distribute. So we're not, again, this is a hypothetical at this point, but we start from the premise of interoperability is good. Authors and publishers making money is good. What do we need to do to help enable that?
Yeah.
Am I understanding correctly that you would have to type in a password every time you open
the... No.
When is the password done?
When you set up your account.
Okay.
Now, if you send it to a friend, they would have to type it in once.
Once, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay, so that's actually a very good question. There is something in the security field called a trusted clock. And there are schemes out there that rely on the trusted clocks of devices, and most of them also have ways of monitoring what the system does to prevent what are known as clock rollback hacks, where somebody, my book's about to expire in a day. I'm going to change the date on my PC kind of thing. So, for example, if you're familiar with File Open, they support an offline mode with expiry date through local security technologies. You don't need to phone home for something like that. It would help if you did, but it can be done offline. Yes?
Do you know of any efforts of putting this kind of DRM into the browser so the browser can, or WebKit can?
It could be done. There's no reason why it couldn't be done. The question was, could you do this in a browser as opposed to an e-reader device or app separately? And the answer is, sure, why not? There aren't that many publishers out there that feel the need to protect HTML, but it does exist. And for example, the biggest example would be a Korean vendor called Fasu, which operates primarily in the corporate document space. And they can protect. They have a browser plugin that will protect, corporate web confidential material that's on the web. So yes, you can do it. Okay, one more question. Yes, in the back. No, unfortunately, no. The question was, is this going to change the nature of the tension, I'm paraphrasing here, between publishers and libraries around e-lending, lending of e-books? Very briefly, this is a point of law rather than technology. It has to do with something called first sale, or if you're not from the U.S., exhaustion. If you are in the U.S., it's Section 109 of the Copyright Act and Section 108 of the Copyright Act. I've written blog posts that say that libraries are going to be in for a very tough time, because unless there is a change in the law, things will not get better for them. So it would be great if we could somehow, through technology, solve this problem, but this isn't going to do it. Okay, I guess we're done here. Thank you very much. Thanks a lot. I'll be happy to take additional questions if you want to come up and talk.